the first mayor of Fishers, history made in an election with historically low voter turnout. How a marriage vote led to the defeat of two state lawmakers and successful school referendums. That, plus Jimmy Irsay's role in the Super Bowl bid, the BMV loses a lawsuit, and Michelle Obama honors the Children's Museum. All that and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 9, 2014.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, the city of Fishers elected its first mayor. Town manager Scott Fadness won the Republican primary in a six-candidate race that produced a low voter turnout on a day when voter turnout hit a 25-year low in some areas. Fadness says his focus will be on keeping Fishers financially stable and giving it a strong identity.
I'm so happy to be here tonight sharing it with all of you. I look around and see so many faces that put it on the line for me day in and day out on this campaign, and that just makes this night that much better. So,
how do you explain the low voter turnout? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Eric Holcomb, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Eric Holcomb, did you expect a better turnout in Fishers?
Well, first, congratulations to Scott. He'll continue to be a great leader for Fishers and that region. I think, by and large, folks were, if you look around the state, there wasn't any statewide elected official on the ballot. There wasn't any overarching state issue that people were all going to the polls for. And I think the folks that I talked to that weren't insiders were saying that, you know, we'll vote in the fall when it really matters. And so people were happy with what they voted for the previous time.
Here in Indianapolis and Marion County, the party leaders did a great job of avoiding meaningful contests. Mm-hmm. That's good for the parties.
It's good for the parties. But, you know, what's interesting about this is I expected a bigger turnout from Fishers. There was a record turnout on the question of whether it was going to be a city or not. But when it came to the election, you know, I guess it was a little bit of a Pollyanna on this, but I should realize that it's actually been part of the Republican mantra over the last few years to discourage voting. I mean, we're making it as difficult as we can. We're not giving early voting. They could have used this as a test case for civic involvement up there, for people who were enthused about it. They could have played it up. They could have done early voting. They could have done all kinds of things to encourage participation. But the Republicans want it decided by a very select few and make it as difficult as possible, and that discourages turnout.
But there weren't a lot of Democrats that turned out either.
There aren't a lot of Democrats.
Well,
in
I'm not talking, just about Fishers. I'm talking
now. We know who they are.
Yeah.
No, but the point is, you can't. It is more difficult to register, and it is more difficult to vote than it needs to be in this county. And with people's schedules, that makes a difference for turnout.
But there were other factors that were more important. Were there not?
In your mind,
you mean
perhaps.
Other factors for the low turnout?
Yes.
As is in that there were no races really that were very hot, or the ones that were. And even in, I mean, I was really startled by Fishers because, as Ann pointed out, that was a very big question for them to convert to a city and then to choose the person who will lead that, because there is no race in the fall, essentially. As Eric said, there are no Democrats in that area that are running for mayor. So I thought that they would turn out. It is startling that there is this much apathy, and we talk about the apathy all the time, yet it continues to get worse. And 12 years ago, the last time we had these same kind of circumstances, we could have said the very same thing, because the turnout was terrible then. There were no statewide ballots or no races like that on the ballot. And I don't know, I think the answer has got to be out there, but I don't think any of us really has a good set of ideas for how to get people to the polls.
The fact of the matter is that if there aren't candidates doing a lot of advertising, people don't go vote.
I suppose you could make an argument there. And again, there wasn't any issue, as everyone has said, that any kind of question or fundamental issue that really had people, you know, foaming at the mouth. Yes, there was an important race, first mayoral race in that city, and you would like to think that people would want and care enough to show up. I don't think necessarily that voter access and ballot access was the issue here in terms of, I'm guessing that if you'd had 3 months of early voting and you'd had a mobile polling place that would pull up in your driveway at your prescribed hour, I doubt you'd have a whole lot more turnout. I don't know what the answer is, as John suggests. It is sad, and you think it would be more because this was the race,
as everybody has noted. Down from 2010, if you compare, right, about 9%. Absentee ballots cast were down as well. So I think it's just a reflection of the mood of the electorate, nothing more.
I actually do think it's more than that. And I think when you do have the kind of, a lot of people told me they didn't know it was an election day.
I think that's true.
And so it's sometimes apathy, sometimes it's lack of knowledge. But if you do the early voting and you do hype it up for the voters, then they're aware of it and they're aware they have a duty to come out, and that makes a difference for turnout. And we're not doing that in Indiana.
All right, to other election news. Three state lawmakers were defeated Tuesday. Two of them were targeted by opponents of gay marriage.
Rebecca Kubacki voted against the constitutional ban on gay marriage known as HJR3. Her opponent, Curtis Nicely, said this about Kubacki in a campaign video.
And she was a leader this year to keep Hoosiers from voting this fall on an amendment to the state constitution to protect and define marriage as one man and one woman.
Kubacki lost. Kathy Hewer also voted against the marriage amendment. Christopher Judy, her opponent, seen here in a candidate profile, focused on that vote.
HJR 3, which was the constitutional amendment for marriage, should have went to the voters in November.
Hewer also lost.
Do you think this was a swing issue?
Yes, I think it was.
Kurt Smith of Indiana Family Action campaigned against both Kubacki and Hewer.
Most politicians will tell you they died a death of 1,000 cuts, but I think this was the most serious cut and did the most significant harm to those two candidates.
Nine other people took the same exact votes as the two candidates that lost last night.
But Megan Robertson of Freedom Indiana sees it differently. She points out that Republicans who voted the same way as Kubacki and Hewer faced no opposition in the primaries. She thinks that helps supporters of gay marriage.
Well, I think it might even embolden others to say, well, there weren't that many primary contests, and maybe I can take a stance on this.
And, Eleni, will those races matter in November?
Well, I think they have the potential of mattering in November, and they even have the potential of mattering in the next session of the General Assembly. I mean, the decision on taking the second sentence out of that amendment was decided by two votes. They're now two votes less. And this is a problem for the Republican Party going forward because it shows a split between the Tea Party people and the more moderate Republicans, and it hasn't played its way out yet. And I expect to see that back. I expect to see something with HJR3 back next legislative session.
Well, I said one of the lessons of this election is that Republican primary voters are more conservative than the public as a whole.
Sure, that's nothing new, but, you know, as a recovering former state party chairman, I'm always reminded on election day that elections aren't decided on one issue alone. And I would agree it could have been a factor. It wasn't the factor. You'd be selling Curt Nicely short. This is a guy whose campaign was vibrant. He had labor. He had evangelicals. He had establishment. His wife is the county chair of Elkhart County. So you throw all that together, and I'm not surprised. He was out working hard. The question will be, will Democrats challenge or compete in the fall in these few races that were exceptions to for incumbents?
Yeah, these were two districts that are very conservative.
Difficult.
They're
right.
Very conservative, and they decided that their Republican representatives weren't conservative enough for them.
That's true, and it wasn't clearly this. I think everybody agrees, including the candidates who were on the short end of the process there in the balloting on Tuesday, say that yes, HJR 3 was an issue. But You also had concerns about Common Cause.
Common Core, not very different, Matt, two things.
Common Core, the education standards that, some conservatives have battled because they see it as a, an overreach by the federal government, even though there is no federal government involvement. And then you also have Second Amendment gun issues that, played into it. Your point remains the same. It's still, those are very conservative districts, and it was an opportunity for people to outmaneuver these incumbents on to their political right.
All of the races that we talked about last week in central Indiana, where there was negative campaigning done, Bob Boehning targeted, Jerry Torr targeted, incumbents had big advantages.
Yeah, and it looks like they either were able to head off their perceived weakness at the time that, they perceived it, or it wasn't really as they weren't really as weak as they thought. The interesting thing about a low turnout is it doesn't take a lot to swing an election like this, and so I think that's what we're seeing. We see two things, especially in those Northeast races, where you have very motivated candidates. And they are backed by people who have similar motivations and bring people out. So you put those two things together, and they often will prevail.
State Senator John Waterman also lost, but that was, from what I understand, mostly local issues.
Yeah, I think the common theme here in these incumbent races that, were defeated, they ran against folks who had very organized campaigns, very organized, and they did a good job of getting out their vote.
All right, three central Indiana school referendums were successful this week, including one in Eminence. Voters needed to sign off on higher taxes there to keep the school open. If not, there was just enough money to stay open for 1 year. Well, the school district worked to consolidate with a neighboring district. 87% of voters supported the referendum.
Can you imagine what it would be like if it weren't here?
It'd be different. I mean, you know, it's been there as long as I can remember.
That was Brett Messer of Eminence there. John Kenzenberger, did low voter turnout help get referendums approved?
Yes, I think low voter turnout does. It goes the same thing. In the other case you saw where people were maybe voting against the incumbent, in this case they were voting for the question. And we saw where all three of them worked out. And actually history has shown that these are kind of toss-up, these referenda are kind of toss-up questions. So to have all three of them pass in the low turnout primary election, I think you'll see a lot of that kind of strategy going forward.
Well, yeah, is the lesson for school administrators here that if you want to get a referendum passed, you should pick the off election year?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily an epiphany for a lot of people who run campaigns. I think when you have something that is seen as maybe the a cause celeb for a minority of the voters, like raising taxes or paying more or defeating an incumbent, it oftentimes does play to your advantage to do it at a time when the turnout is not going to be great. But beyond these three districts, you also had, nine out of ten on a broader look statewide. That's a pretty good batting average when, as John points out, they're typically a 50-50 proposition.
Yeah. You worked for Mitch Daniels, who at one point...
I don't know if he'd say that, but yeah.
At one point, he was advocating large regional school districts, doing away with the, even large school districts in some cases. This Eminence keeping its school district, does that make sense in the big picture?
I love it. I love that locals are making the decisions in their communities, and so I think it makes sense. And some of the ones that fall short will be back again, I think. And usually when you talk to the people in the communities where they fall short, they say, well, it's not that I disagree with it, but I wasn't sure of the value of the taxpayers. You know, we were going to get our value out of it. So I think that some of them will be back.
I think you're going to see more of these because the school districts are so pinched. We're not back to the funding of education we had before Mitch Daniels.
And a lot of these, a lot of these now are about transportation.
Well, but they're about budgets. They're about the property tax cap, which is funded which funds transportation and infrastructure. And then you've got the decrease in funding for teachers and ongoing education. And in that decreased funding, you now have it spread out on vouchers and charter schools. So a lot of these smaller schools are really feeling the pinch. The encouraging part of this in the middle of that terrible news is that people have indicated a willingness to pay for education. And I think they'll pay for law enforcement as well because they see value in it, and that's good.
I think that's right. Moving away from the election, the Indianapolis bid to host Super Bowl 52 in 2018 is now in the hands of all 32 NFL team owners. The bid committee unveiled a copy of the 900-page proposal this week. It calls for an expanded Super Bowl Village, another legacy project, and it includes a commitment of $30 million by the corporate community to pay for hosting the event. But perhaps the biggest news was about Colts owner Jim Irsay.
I'm the owner of the Colts, Jim Irsay. A, do you know, will he be there? And B, if not, will that hurt?
Jim's planning on being at the meeting, yes. Every owner of the franchises whose city is bidding has a chance to talk for 5 minutes. And so he will be doing, he plans on talking to the ownership.
Pete Ward of the Colts there, John Schwantes, will that help the Indianapolis bid?
Oh, I think so. I mean, keep in mind, this, again, is, as you pointed out in your introduction, is a decision made by a very elite club, you might say, with
32
the
members.
32 members of the club. And as with any organization, presumably, if you're going to be persuaded on an issue, you want to hear from one of your fellow club members to continue the metaphor. And I think it will certainly won't hurt Indianapolis's bid at all.
And if you're him, and you're worried that your recent arrest might have a negative effect, you want a chance to explain yourself, right?
Well, and I think that he'll also take that opportunity before his fellow owners. He's very popular among the people who own the NFL franchise. It is a small club. They probably want to hear what he thinks about his arrest and his situation in the meantime, and they'll want to know about the Super Bowl. So I'm sure he will get up there and he'll do whatever it is that he does that makes him so popular with the rest of the owners. And I don't think it'll have any poor effect on the bid. It'll probably help it.
A lot of speculation that New Orleans is the favorite.
You know, we can't control that. All we can do is put forth the best presentation we can. And I think he's right to talk. It's not as if the arrest is a secret. They all know about that. And so giving him the chance to explain it and to make the pitch for the city, it seems to me, just makes perfect sense.
I think there's no substitute for an owner looking in another owner's eyes. They've all had their ups and downs throughout life. And he has proven that, and Indianapolis has proven, that we can exceed expectations. So I look forward to having home field advantage in 2018 in the Super Bowl.
Well, that would be nice. A lot of people expect that he will receive some sort of league penalty for what he's gone through here. Does it matter on the timing of that, whether it's before or after the Super Bowl bid?
No, I think everyone's rooting for him to fully recover and us to get on track.
And get help.
Yeah.
Well, he's gotten help, apparently, and been to rehab and back, so developments to come. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, will a sales pitch from Jim Irsay help or hurt the Super Bowl bid? Your choices are A, help, B, hurt, or C, no effect. Last week's question was, should congressional candidates be required to live in the district where they run? 95% said yes, it's common sense. 5% said no, the voters can figure it out. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The Indiana Bureau of Motor Vehicles lost a lawsuit this week, and a judge ordered it to resume issuing personalized license plates. It was Greenfield police officer Rodney Vauder who sued the BMV. His fight was over a personalized Fraternal Order of Police license plate that reads OINK. That's a term the BMV found to be inappropriate, offensive, and misleading.
Many arrests, I've been called a pig to my face. And a person has that freedom of speech, and I have to accept that as an officer. I don't treat them any different just because they call me a pig. So they find it humorous, so I thought it'd be humorous.
And Delaney, wait times are better at license branches, but is the BMV still badly managed?
Well, this was a mistake. I mean, they should have simply issued the plate that he'd been given a number of years before.
It was given to him a couple of times at least and then denied, right?
Right. And when you look at how arbitrary the denials were, Haters was permitted. I mean, the problem with this is the state doesn't have to give personalized plates at all. It doesn't have to issue them. But once they issue them, the First Amendment applies to the license plates as well as everything else. You can't legislate good taste any more than you can legislate judgment. The statute prescribes what they're allowed, what they're not allowed to have on the back of the license plates, and they ought to stay strictly within those parameters and stop trying to dictate taste as well.
This ruling came out a couple of days ago. One of the things the judge did was say you have to resume the program. The BMV hasn't announced what it's going to do next yet. What's going on there?
Well, I think it will be interesting to see what the administration and the attorney general, how they react to this order that basically overturns a statute. There are rules. It's kind of a balance of eye of beholder versus...
It's a Democrat judge. Does that matter?
I don't think so. I think it's a balance of... You know, when I saw oink, I thought of bacon. So, you know, I mean...
So it could be a pig farm.
It could be. So
that's the problem. I mean, they have certain things they can't say, and they ought to just leave it at that. We've done that for years.
Right.
They shouldn't do what they're doing.
But we've recently seen another lawsuit, a couple of them, over fees that were overcharged. It's another black eye for the BMV.
Well, it shows that personalized plates have become political speech in many cases. You look at the organization, not just the messages on them, but some of the lawsuits you're talking about are the sponsoring organizations who are effectively the ones who benefit in some fashion from, you know, and there have been several organizations that are, you know, not only is there a judgment about whether you can say certain things on the plate, but the other problem is, what organizations are sanctioned and acceptable as the endorsers of those plates. And that's problematic. But this issue has gone on. I mean, this is not necessarily a Republican administration issue, because I remember doing a story years ago during the Biden administration, and they had a sweet lady who would sort of be the final arbiter of what was acceptable or not, and she allowed the word no on a plate, but it rejected yes. So that's no joke. So I mean,
you can't legislate.
You can't.
You know, it is interesting, though. The last time the BMV had these kinds of problems, it was still part of the patronage system of the county party in power. And so they do have some administrative issues over the last several years that need to be cleaned up. And if you look at them in toto, it can be seen as embarrassing and maybe a problem. So I think that there is some concern here.
Should they appeal or should they just resume?
They should just resume and because they're not going to win on appeal.
No. And it's a waste of resources.
Finally, the Indianapolis Children's Museum received an honor from First Lady Michelle Obama this week. It's one of 10 recipients of this year's National Medal for Museum and Library Service. Not only did the museum president accept the award, but he had help from 8-year-old Spencer Hahn and his mother. Doctors thought Spencer would never walk or talk, but his family says the Children's Museum helped him move past that, and he stole the show during the presentation.
Spencer responded. The museum provided an environment where Spencer felt happy and safe. At the Playscape exhibit, which was created to encourage the youngest kids to reach developmental milestones, Spencer took his first steps. After that,
Eric Holcomb, does it help to have the First Lady tell us that the Children's Museum is a treasure?
I think she knows what we've all known for a long time, and what a great story. And I would suggest if you haven't been to the Children's Museum, you make a Mother's Day weekend out of it.
Whether you're a child or not.
Right.
Whether you have
That's
a child
right.
with you or not.
That's right.
Right.
Go find one and take
right.
one. It's a great treasure, and it's a wonderful story.
The exhibit that they have now with the terracotta warriors from China is the only time it'll be in the U.S. this year, and it's going to be spectacular.
I remember the pleasure of going to the Children's Museum when it was in basically a house.
Oh, I remember that, too.
A house. Yeah. And that's not an exaggeration.
Yeah.
And it was a treasure then, and it's a treasure now.
All right, before we go, one time around the table, who is the big winner in the primary election?
How about Judge Pettit
in Boone County, who defeated Jim Holden, who was Richard Murdoch's campaign manager, running for judge?
I think, by and large, the voters, their voice spoke volumes.
Oh, however few of them showed up. However
their voice few of them showed couldn't up. Hear. It was a whisper.
I think more people watched the Pacers or the Voice.
You have to have double-digit turnout for them to actually be able to express their voice. I suppose whether it was the driving factor, the Family Institute, Kurt Smith, and those that were able to say, hey, we're a voice, listen to us.
Yeah, because they definitely were able to flex their muscles in elections where the Indiana Chamber, backing the incumbents, were not.
Right. Yeah, and gay marriage opponents in an election largely devoid of winners. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Eric Holcomb, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast or starting Monday. You can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.